All right, if everybody could take their seats and we'll get started. We'll wait till we get a quorum to bring them to official order. Is Representative Mack in the room? Yes, she is. Representative Mack, House File 795. We can't move it until we get a few more people, but if you'd like to begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Morning.
Mr. Chair, House File 795, that's in front of you today, has been several years in the making. I have carried this bill the past couple of years, and basically what we are attempting to do with this is get Minnesota to be a part of a very exciting thing that's happening across the country. As we as policymakers often sit down and look at legislation to either build on programs, build new programs, one of the challenges that we always have in ongoing debates is what kind of return on taxpayer investment are we getting for the programs that we're investing in? And we can debate that all day long, but I believe that this bill brings in a tool that could potentially provide that going forward, where members would have a mechanism by which they would know what kind of return on investment they're getting. And so, members, what this bill does is it would capitalize on an opportunity that the Pugh MacArthur Results First program is putting forth, where states can be come to the table, be a part of this, where you basically bring in data from your public programs, from things that you're spending money on, and they have created a mechanism by which you can calculate what kind of return on investment that you're getting. The bill in front of you would put out money for a FTE to kind of be the corollary between the state and the Pugh MacArthur Foundation. And so that is at the very high level of what we're doing here. I do have a testifier with me today that knows much more of the details about the proposal and the potential that's out there in partnering with Pugh MacArthur, along with other states that have been a part of this and the exciting possibilities that are there. But I'm doing this on behalf of we as policymakers, future policymakers, to make even better decisions, as well as how it can translate to the counties and the incredible work that the counties are doing as a legislative arm of the state, and the challenges that they face, and that this could be a real tool in their hands as well. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd love to turn over our testifier.
Okay, Representative Mack, we'll just pause for a second to bring the committee to order, the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee, and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson. Representative Considine. Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Hertas. Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lohmer.
Here.
Representative Lucero. Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Rosenthal. Representative Schoen. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Winkler. And Representative Zerwas.
Here. Representative Lohmer, would you like to move the minutes of March 25th?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Lohmer moves the minutes of March 25th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Now we're back to the bill, House File 795. The chair will move to pass and refer to the State Government Finance Committee. Is that right, Representative Mack?
I believe it's actually going to, I thought it was going to Health and Human Services Finance, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, what? I am okay with whatever's been decided prior to, you know, me being here, if the CA has been working on it behind the scenes.
We'll talk a little more about it. If we need to change the motion by the end of the presentation, we can too. But for now, the State Government Finance. And, sir, would you like to state your name and title and begin?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Kelly Harder. I am here on behalf of the county's representative in MICA. In my day job, I'm also the Community Services Director at Dakota County. Thank you for your time today, Mr. Chair and committee members. What you have in front of you is a bill that would enact an opportunity, as Representative Mack suggested, as policymakers, and you're getting a handout now as well that you'll be able to take a look at. What we want to offer up is an opportunity, and there's a platform and a framework that has been engaged on a national level. Its basis comes out of the Washington State Institute of Public Policy, where they had built the analytics capabilities. And they started in the correction space, and that's where they have the most years of experience. But they have expanded into human services, child welfare, mental health, some education, et cetera. And we just come to you in previous years it was to study, is this something that would be helpful for policymakers? And now we come to you, there was such interest around the country. I believe also in your packet you have a handout of the across the country that there's over 16 states to varying degrees of maturity and varying degrees of depth that they have worked with Pew Institute. Pew Institute actually would come to the state of Minnesota if leadership agrees that would be a preferred. And they bring technical assistance, and they also bring the sophisticated methodology they use to do the data runs to get the return on taxpayer investments that then would be presented to you. You all, I'm sure, often get many cost-benefit analysis presented to you. If only you invest in my program, you will save $7. And then another next one comes up, and they'll save $8. The next one comes up. The issue is not whether or not those are valid. I'm not here to question that. And in fact, I'm sure you may hear and you've seen many out of the Department of Corrections, which are extremely well done and extremely valid. The issue is there's no consistent or regular process or content or framework at which those come to you in. So think as a policymaker in the document you just received where you might be able someday to sit in this committee, look at programs that are in front of you being asked for tax dollars investments, and being able to add to the dialogue that you all have, add to the decision-making you all have, whether that's a priority place where you put taxpayer dollars. It's not a value statement. These are priority statements because there are only so many resources. I will also say, being here on behalf of counties, this would be a wonderful tool that is being used across the country to varying degrees that we could use at a local level because when I'm not here, every other Tuesday, I'm in front of my board. And for me to be able to use, and in particular in corrections, where community corrections has a disproportionate number of individuals in the state, in the community, we're making sure to stay safe. We need this very type of methodology as well to help the policymaking and the taxpayer investments at the local level. So we believe that this is something that is beyond a concept. It's moved out throughout the state. There's a few counties in California. This is new with Pew MacArthur that are being used. We're suggesting it would be housed at MMB and that they would then work with departments, whether it's Department of Corrections or Department of Human Services, and assist with resourcing that to be able to get the data out and to work with Pew and their technical assistance to be able to get this, to get Minnesota's return on investment methodology built out. So I want to also be really clear that this is not a methodology that needs to take the place of or be in lieu of already affirmed and valid methods you and other departments use, whether it's the Department of Corrections, whether it's the Department of Human Services. It's not in place of. I see this as a complement and augmentation too. So with that, Mr. Chair, committee members, I would also stand for any questions.
Hey, members, questions? Representative Hillsprung.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm very supportive of this concept. I've been following what they've been doing in Washington State for a very long time and have always wondered and even tried unsuccessfully on one or more occasion to replicate much of what they do in Washington State. My question is, how do you envision this working with the legislative auditor to make sure that we are being consistent rather than inconsistent in the way we're evaluating programming?
Whichever one you'd like to answer, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, number one, thank you for your support and vote of support in regard to the WSIP Washington Institute policy. The other thing, before I answer your question, I also did not mention, but the other beauty about being a part of this is you sit at a table, a community of practice on a national level. We would find ourselves as a state to sit with the other states who are also learning from this experience. So we can learn not to do certain things maybe they wish they wouldn't have done or to get a head start on other areas. I cannot and will not speak on behalf of the Legislative Auditor's Office, but I will state that I did have a conversation with the head of that office, and our conversation was very positive, and they were very positive as well. I think the concept of having greater uniformity and consistency and translatability of a tool that cuts across programs horizontally and vertically, as it even goes down to the county, I've asked, is this the only thing out there? Well, it's the only thing I know that has the capacity to replicate across programs across the state and also down into county operations as well. So I can't speak on behalf of them, but I have had conversations, and those went very positive.
Thank you. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I've kind of got a twofold question or two questions. The FTE you spoke about, can you clarify that, whether that's going to be a state employee working for MMB? Is that going to be a contract person from WSSIP? Is that going to be from Pew? Exactly, you know, that FTE, where does that fall in, and who's going to cover the cost?
Mr. Harder or Representative Mack?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be a employee of MMB dedicated to this work, in that one of the requirements Pew has is that they would have an identified state liaison, that their national liaison, who's in charge of implementing in the states, would work with them individually as well. So it would make sure we're going to have adequate resources, that if a decision is to do this, that we have resources that follow to make sure it does get done.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, when you mentioned the counties, now and I'm a little leery of unfunded mandates that we put down to our local level. So how do they fit in? Is this an additional reporting requirement? How does that mesh in with this program? And I'm a little touchy on the unfunded mandate piece.
Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I thank you as a county employee that you're sensitive to those unfunded mandate options, so we appreciate that. You know, at the county level, we see this as having as much and enough value. We will prioritize resources. We're not going to come forward with another fiscal note. I believe, and when I'm in front of my board, who makes the decisions about fiscal appropriation with local tax dollars as well, I owe them this level of conversation, not just what are we doing programmatically that's changing lives and helping and keeping communities safe. I also owe them the business methodology on the backside, so they can tell their constituents what that dollar invested returned to them. And not in some non-tangential or flowery way, but to say, you know, when I'm back home, I'm from Southwest Minnesota down in Cottonwood County, and here's my litmus test in my business up here. If I can go back and explain to my dad and his coffee buddies at the coffee shop what their dollar invested meant, whether it's a human service, a corrections, public health, veteran services, if I can make that correlation, and I'll tell you one thing that works, talk about real legitimate dollar investment and what you get back, that translates well in the community. So it would be a cost, but it's one I would reprioritize resources to make sure it happens. It's of that much value at the local level.
Okay, Representative Dean, and if we could keep our answers and questions short as possible. We got 8 bills to go through today. Representative Dean, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mack and Mr. Carter. I think it's fascinating that today, as you're bringing this forward in Washington, D.C., there's a bipartisan summit on criminal justice reform that includes, hosted by Newt Gingrich and Van Jones. So I'm very encouraged that this is becoming really bipartisan. What we're I don't have any water. Bipartisan in that we're trying to address these issues for not just is it the right thing to do, but also as a way of really sort of using our resources appropriately. And I've had the opportunity to work with Department of Corrections regarding Justice Reinvestment, which is a program with the Council of State Governments, Bureau of Justice Administration, as well as the Pew as well. So we're also seeing a step up from private foundations to these issues. And I guess my question that I would put forward to you is, do you see this as an overlapping? Do you see this as something that is in concert with the current work that's been being done in other areas? Because they're working in other states as well, and it seems like there are a lot of groups trying to address these situations and these issues. And I think the issues around are we appropriately spending our resources is really what the crux is. So if you could speak to if it's in contradiction or in concert or if there's overlap.
Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, I will succinctly attempt to answer by saying it has to be in concert with, and where and when the Department of Corrections or Human Services or others already have a model and methodology that is approved and we're not going to question, use that. Why would we say this has to take its place, one of the first things Pew will do is they come in and do an environmental scan. And they will make recommendations based on what we have. They may say, what you have there, which most likely they will, let's do that. Let's go with that. It's not about replacing, nor is it in competition too. I know MMB ultimately has spoken to the idea of having a resource list for the state of Minnesota by all its programs, by different departments, whether the ROI comes out of this tool or other tool, but minimally there would be a sense of ROI that we could resource to.
And then one other
question.
Mr. Chair, and I'm assuming that this program is going to look through the full spectrum, so it's not just about individuals and adult corrections. This will also look at juveniles. We'll also look at families in those other situations as well.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ward. Oh, Representative Mack, you want
to? Mr. Chair, just briefly, I was just going to refer to the handout that was given to members that gives kind of the full spectrum of just how broad this can be in terms of programs it can look at and measure from other states. And so, yes, it is much broader than any individual program. It's quite impressive, the build-out potential of something like this.
Okay, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having organization development background and working with Baldrige Quality in the past, I really appreciate this. And I've heard something about it going through the legislature before. I'm curious as to what the barriers were. What have we learned from addressing those barriers, and how are we going to make it different this time so we can actually implement this?
Hey, Representative O'Neill. Or did you want a response?
I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, just briefly, I think the challenge in the past, Representative Ward, because I think this is our third time with this bill, it's always been a fairly relatively smaller dollar amount, but the challenge has been in the past, the proposal has been more to look at an RFP, if you will, to do something like this and study. I think what gets particularly exciting this year about this bill is now we actually have a trigger to pull, a model that's ready. All we have to do is buy in, be a part of this, go to the table with Pew and all these other states. In conversation now with the Senate and the governor to all be moving in the right direction as we've got something tangible to really grab onto this year.
Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Mack, for bringing this. So as you referenced this handout where it has this great chart, you know, charts and graphs and rankings of different programs and their effectiveness, and I just happen to flip open to the first one. It says juvenile justice, and it ranks, you know, the from top to bottom as to what's the most successful or most cost-effective. The bill that we have in front of us, would it take it all the way to this level, Representative Mack, where we would actually be able to implement that? Or, like, help me understand, where does this bring us, where are we left, and how do we get to the point where we can actually look at every single one of our committees and jurisdictions and have all of our programs ranked like this so we know where the effectiveness is?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the sake of expediency, I'll have Mr. Harder answer that question just because he's been in more regular contact with Pew in terms of the mechanics of rolling it out.
Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, that is the end state desired goal. And I believe whether that menu is everything that came through Pew or with Pew in addition to good work DOC is currently doing or in addition to other ROIs as a policymaker. As a decision maker that I make back at the county, I look at those. If there's other ROIs that are valid, I just care that there's one there, and I care that it's valid, and it contributes to my decision priority making of tax dollars as well. Year one to year two, we also have to calibrate our appetite in that we'd like to start and be at that end state sooner than later. But to do it right, you know, there's a lot of data, there's a lot of different systems, and they weren't built to integrate well. So it's going to take some work and heavy lift, but let's do the right work and the infrastructural work right at the beginning, and I think over time we'll be able to grow out that menu in a quicker forum than it'll be originally.
Representative O'Neill?
Just a very quick follow-up. So do you have any sense as to how long it would take us to get to this point where we would literally have something as simple as a chart in front of us to say, you know, this has got $11.21 or ratio compared to zero or negative benefit? I mean, this is amazing. This would be very helpful in every committee.
Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, it wouldn't be responsible for me to say, here's the date. I will say that the beauty of being in Minnesota and legislating in Minnesota, we have a lot of these programs already enacted in Minnesota, and so it'd be a matter of putting our data into this methodology. It's already there. They don't have to reformulate or recook that up. So I think over, like I said, if we do it right on the front end, over time, you'll get more and more of that as available. I would also encourage you to go to Pew, where they already have repository of all ROIs across the country who come out of many databases in this area of programs we already do in Minnesota.
Okay, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a former program director for the Blue Earth County Jail, I think this is a great idea. However, I am reminded early to mid-90s there was a female offender unit in the DOC that was trying to just go around the state of Minnesota and get all the best practices together so they would be available to the greater Minnesota county jails. And what actually ended up happening was they eliminated the female offender unit. So it never got done. So I'm hoping, wishing you good luck. Thank you.
Okay, we have another testifier. Commissioner Roy, would you like to testify now?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Tom Roy. I'm Commissioner of Corrections for the state of Minnesota. I'm here to speak to current state within the Department of Corrections, and since we are so prominently noted in this bill, I think it's important for you to have an understanding of where we are at with research and outcome studying. Actually, Pew Foundation noted that Minnesota is one of the top 10 states, and primarily because of the corrections outcome studies. We have been recognized as being far ahead of most of the country already in terms of the research we're doing and the research around investment and return on investment. The chart that you were given, the spreadsheet that actually notes the programs, you will see many Minnesota corrections programs listed on that as being robust in research and also having great results. We're pretty proud of our work. I cannot sit here and speak for the MMB and potential that this has for a statewide implementation, nor can I speak for the governor's office. My only intent is to speak to the state of affairs in terms of our corrections department. We are second lowest in the country in terms of incarceration. We spend half as much of general fund money as the state of Washington as a percentage in terms of correctional spending. We are very proud of the work that we do. The research that we have done has identified in the corrections world what works. Every part of our 20 research projects that we've had in the past 5 years has had a return on investment component to it. We know that education gets a great return. We know that employment gets a great return. We know that chemical dependency, sex offender gets a great return. I sat here 2 years ago and showed you a outcome study on treatment, and as a result of showing you the outcomes, you gave us money to increase those programs. Wisely done. So we definitely support research, and we support research that shows return on investment. I just need to assure you that our current projects that Representative Dean mentioned with the Council of State Governments is a major initiative that mirrors this very closely. We also have a major Bureau of Justice Assistance recidivism reduction project going on that is also data-driven and results-driven. I have great respect for Pew. But I just need to assure you that we are already going down this road in the Department of Corrections, and I can only speak for the Department of Corrections this morning.
Okay, subliminal message. If we don't finish here today, we're coming back 15 minutes after session on Thursday night. So, Representative Hilsman.
Thank you. So, Commissioner Roy, I'm just going to cut to the chase. So, do you want the Department of Corrections deleted from this bill and just to leave the Department of Human Services, or are you supportive of staying in the bill?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we support research-based studies that show if government is effective. Whether this is the model or not, I'm going to leave to you folks. We are confident that we're doing this work in the Department of Corrections already. We will certainly support if MMB says we should participate. We will certainly do that.
Mr. Chair, just quickly follow
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner Roy, do you believe that doing this would undo what you've already done?
I believe there will be some duplication. I believe that the fact that we are already listed in the Pew Research as being state-of-the-art in many ways, if I could say that we could never be better, I would be a fool. We can always be better.
Mr. Chair, just a final comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner and Representative Mack, I would encourage you to talk to each other to figure out, because we don't want to fund a project that is going to duplicate what they're already doing when they're doing it well, and we want to make certain that whatever ends up passing actually benefits the state. And that's all.
Okay. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just like you, I'm not sure where you are in this, but there is the Minnesota Association of Jail Programs and Services that have been doing things like this since the early 90s. I would encourage you to include them in your discussions. Thank you.
Okay. Representative or Commissioner, a quick answer.
Mr. Chair, I hope I've emphasized enough that this initiative is way more than the Department of Corrections. And I am only sitting here speaking for that small component of this effort. And Representative Mack may certainly have bigger ambitions in terms of how this influences legislation in other departments and initiatives as well.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one thing that I think of when I always think about numbers, when I always think about pulling together these things to say, is something effective or not effective? I always come back to the saying that I heard many, many years ago, that not everything that can be measured is of value, and not everything of value can be measured. So I think we always also need to do some discretion in the lens that we look through these numbers on, and really, when we get to that point of evaluation, really take a hard look, because some numbers might look great, but they might not really do much of anything. So just as a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any Representative Mack, did you want to?
I was just, final word on the bill, Mr. Chair, if we're at that point. I was just going to say to some of the concerns, we have been meeting, to Representative Hilstrom's question, with the Commissioner of DHS, and the Commissioner of Public Safety here just the other day to work some of this stuff out. As Mr. Harder said, I don't think the intention is to duplicate work to the extent possible. Pew comes in and assesses what could be done. And I do know Pew likes to start with corrections because it tends to be the biggest bang for the buck in terms of turning around some of this ROI information. But the real excitement, particularly in my opinion, working in HHS extensively, is the build-out of this, as well as the translatability down to the county level that I believe Pew brings to the table in a very, you know, impactful way for us. And so we will definitely continue to talk to the point that we can minimize duplication and unnecessary work, absolutely. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Mack. Any public testimony? All right. Seeing none and no questions, the chair will renew his motion. And Representative Mack, we did recheck, and I guess they want it in state government finance. So. Okay. The chair will move House File 795 to pass and refer to State Government Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. House File 518, Representative Scott. Representative Scott, the chair will move House File 518 to pass and refer to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. And House File 518 is a result of a child custody working group that we've been working a large contingency of us for 2.5 years with stakeholders from all areas of family law. And I'll just get right to the what the bill does.
Representative Scott, should we adopt your author's amendment?
Oh, we do have an author's amendment.
Sorry,
yes,
about that. Chair will move the A1 amendment to get it in the shape the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, sorry, Representative Scott, go ahead. No.
Thank you. Do you want me to go ahead with the bill or explain
yes,
the amendment?
Please, just the whole bill as amended.
All right, thank you, Chair. House Bill 518 clarifies that the presumption of 25% parenting time is a floor, not a ceiling. It's just a small word change. And you see that on 2.16. The current language is at least 25%. We're changing it to a minimum of 25%. This bill also provides for compensatory parenting time when a substantial amount of court-ordered parenting time is unavailable unless it would be not in the child's best interest, and it would award that compensatory parenting time. It also allows for comp time when court-ordered parenting time is denied by one of the other parents, and it would allow for civil penalties and costs, including attorney fees. After the second court filing that one party has repeatedly and intentionally denied the other parent court-ordered parenting time, the civil penalties become mandatory. The third section allows parties to make changes in spousal maintenance by agreement when previously the ability to modify was limited. It requires a party, this bill also requires a party who has not provided their tax return to the other party that they are required to provide supporting tax documents. Also allows for alternative start dates of newly modified child support and spousal maintenance awards if both parties agree. And that is a summation of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Scott, when we heard this bill in civil law, I asked if you're allowing civil penalties when one parent refuses to turn over the child for visitation. My question then was, then why are you not allowing for that same penalty when one parent refuses to pick up the child when it's there?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom and Mr. Chair. As I stated in civil law, our group didn't even approach that subject. As I recall, I don't know if my testifier recalls that we talked about that. That's certainly something that, you know, could be looked at in the future. But the bills that we brought forward here come out of the purview of that working group, and it's what we could find consensus upon.
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you have consensus completely on the A1 amendment, who now makes this mandatory for more than one? How did you come to consensus on that?
I'll let the testifier answer that question.
Go ahead, sir.
Sure. My name is Michael D. Dittberger. I'm the legislative chair of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. And what the A1 amendment is attempting to do is to follow an amendment that was made in the Senate Judiciary Committee that deals with circumstances where somebody violates a court order requiring the provision of income and employment information and allowing an alternative effective date. In that instance is what the legislation originally provided for. Our DHS found out from national DHS that would violate a prohibition against retroactive modification of support. So the A1 amendment, as passed by the Senate Judiciary Committee, in which we're asking this committee to also adopt so that both bills get aligned with each other, is intended to try to have an alternative means of addressing that particular problem when somebody basically violates a court order requiring the provision of income information. They could have an avenue by which they can seek redress.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that was not the working group issue. That was an issue that the Senate put on the bill. Is that what I'm to understand?
Yeah, that's what the A1 amendment does.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Uh-huh.
If I might.
Yeah, Representative Scott.
Thank you. What the A1 does is clarify a work product that we had already come up with. It wasn't a new idea or a new subject matter. It was clarifying because DHS had an issue with one section of this bill as it regards to tax filings. So we had to make sure that our bill wasn't, that it was conforming, that they would be in, that they would be conforming with federal law. So it wasn't new subject matter.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I'm trying to figure out. I want to make sure that if we're doing consensus bills, that the working group thinks there's consensus around that we're only doing the consensus provisions, because otherwise,
you know, once we, you know, rip off the Band-Aid and we're going to allow all these other provisions in that had nothing to do with the working group, I've got a few amendments of my own.
Right. I understand that. Yeah. And we were very, our group, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, are very, we're very dedicated to one another to try and keep these bills as tight as possible and as close to original language as possible without additional topics being amended on.
Okay. Any other questions? Any other testifiers? Any public testimony? Any closing comments?
Just would appreciate the committee's support as we move through the process. Thank you.
Okay. Chair will renew his motion for House File 518 to pass as amended and referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Okay, carried. Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Atkins? We'll switch order a little bit here. I think this would be a rather quick one, and Representative Atkins has got a meeting to go through, so we'll put him in here and get him done.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Atkins, where is his bill?
There is an office amendment.
It's the House File 1947 to be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. I'll move your bill. Go ahead, Representative Atkins. You got an author's amendment?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
The chair will move the A1 amendment to House File 1947. And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, Representative Atkins, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last year, you'll recall, we passed the kill switch bill. House File 1947 just fixes an unintended consequence. The kill switch bill prohibited cash payments for used cell phones. Before the kill switch bill passed, there was a company, EcoATM, that had 15 kiosks in shopping malls around the state where they purchased and recycled about 15,000 cell phones. Our desire was not to put those folks in jeopardy, but unfortunately we did. They've actually worked with law enforcement around the state to build in security measures to make sure the cell phones that they purchase are not lost or stolen. And House File 1947 allows these kiosks to begin operating again as long as all their transactions are reported to law enforcement. The bill passed unanimously in the House Commerce Committee, but there were some concern about collection and storage of thumbprints of the individuals selling their cell phones. That's the reason the bill was referred to this committee. My author's amendment deletes that thumbprint provision. And with that, I would appreciate your support, Mr. Chair and members.
Any questions from any members? Any other testimony that you have?
I have folks here to answer questions, but since we took out the provision that caused it to come here, I was hoping that that might suffice.
Okay. Any public testimony? All right. Seeing no questions and no public testimony, the chair will renew his motion for House File 1947 to pass, move to, as amended, move to the General Register, is it?
Yes.
Alden, Representative Filsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, sorry, Representative Atkins, I was still talking about the child support bill when you started. So I just want to make sure that so all that's left is that they're going to report to a law enforcement authority with jurisdiction that the purchase was made. They're just not going to do the thumbprint. Is that
right?
So it still should have come here.
It still should have come here. We took out the provision that was what raised a concern in the Commerce Committee.
Okay.
Okay, you heard my previous motion. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
The gold star for your brevity. Representative Vogel, House File 1703.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Representative Vogel's bill.
Okay. I guess we're moving. Representative Zerwas will move motion to lay over your bill for possible inclusion, House File 1703. Representative Vogel, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. First of all, I didn't want to usurp or not do my duty as a freshman, so enjoy the treats. Maybe the sugar will keep us all going for a while.
Thank you.
A very straightforward bill. Just a thing that the bill changes to the tax, makes some changes to tax court procedure, and, and jurisdiction in line with similar provisions in the district court. It also allows the use of certain restricted funds for operating expenses in the current biennium. It has three parts. First of all, the written order extends the time for the serving a motion for a rehearing from 15 to 30 days and the time to hear the motion from 30 to 60 days. Secondly, it increases the monetary threshold for small claims division from $5,000 to $15,000 for cases not involving valuation assessment and taxation of property. And third, provides for amends the rider language for the current biennium to allow the funds dedicated to law clerks, CLA cost, and Westlaw to be used for operating expenses and makes the funds in the first year available in the second year. Mr. Chair, that'd be it.
Do you have any other testifiers? I see somebody's listed here. If you could just come up and say if this really came from you folks and if it's approved, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joanne Turner, Chief Judge of the Tax Court, and I'm here in support of the bill, and thanks to Representative Vogel for sponsoring it. This is a bill that the Tax Court has put forward, and we are in support of it. It will simplify matters for taxpayers. It's largely taxpayer-friendly, and for that reason, we ask for your support.
Okay. Members, any questions? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just... And I guess I'm a little confused how this helps the taxpayer, because it looks like it delays the taxpayer from getting a response from the tax court. Or I guess explain to me, if I'm headed to tax court and I've had to file for tax court, how does this affect me as a taxpayer who's objecting to what the Department of Revenue is taxing me? How does this help me as a taxpayer?
Judge Turner?
Chairman Cornish, Representative Howe, the bill helps taxpayers in the following ways. First, with respect to post-trial motions, both in our court and in district court, once we have ruled, the parties have a certain length of time in which to make a post-trial motion. Those motions can be anything from you guys have screwed up on the law to you've made a mathematical mistake in the calculation. Sometimes we do, our calculations are quite complex. 15 days is not a lot of time in which to make those motions if you've got to consult with a client and get the motion filed. The other problem, quite frankly, is there parties have 30 days to do this in district court, but only 15 days to do it in our court. We're subject to two sets of rules. We're subject to the rules of civil procedure by statute, and we have this separate rule written into statute. And that's confusing for taxpayers who come to a district court for our cases and don't realize we're not district court judges. It's confusing for parties who know that there are two different limits but then have to figure out which one applies and guess wrong. We want to correct these mistakes when we make them. We want to be able to fix them. Because if we can't fix them, the grounds for fixing them are much more difficult to bring. The threshold is much higher. And really, they're limited to doing it on appeal. So when the tax court was formed, those two deadlines were the same. The district court extended theirs over time, and ours just never got changed. That's the reason for doing that. On the small claims side, again, our small claims procedures are like conciliation court. They're streamlined. We get those cases to trial much, much faster than we can in regular division. Our small claims limit hasn't been increased in almost 30 years. We're just asking that it be increased to the same dollar limit as in conciliation court.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming to the committee. So the language that you're changing here is from my budget. So, of course, I'm curious as to what it is that you want to spend the money on that the language I gave you doesn't allow you to spend the money on.
Judge Turner.
Chairman Cornish, Representative Hilstrom, first, thank you for the money. Thank you, thank you, thank you again. We have an unintended surplus in that budget line, a relatively small amount, because, quite frankly, one of our law clerks is on maternity leave for a few months, and we're going to have some salary savings. What we'd like to put that money toward is our new case management system. We have a consultant who's doing the groundwork and the legwork for that system, who's writing the RFP, doing all the diagrams that are going to be necessary in order for us to go out and solicit bids for us if we are so fortunate as to get funding for that in the next biennium. And that's what we'd like to be able to put those monies toward. It's not going to be very much money. It's not going to be a real large surplus. But right now, it's unclear whether, under the rider language that's attached to the current appropriation, whether we are limited to using it for those specified purposes or whether we can apply it toward our other operating expenses. And we're just asking for that to be clarified.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Filsburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm fine with you using it for that particular purpose. I would have preferred that it came in with language specifically authorizing you to use it for a case management system rather than striking that we wanted it to go for law clerks and continuing legal education and WAS law costs, because we wanted to make it clear that those were important. And in fact, in this budget, you're asking for an additional law clerk. And so we don't want to find out that, you know, you're not taking the law clerks that we allocated for you and ultimately using the money for something else.
Right. And Representative
Hillstrom
and Chairman Cornish, we have used those monies wisely, but understand, too, that it took almost 6 months for those positions to be created by management and budget. And we filled them as soon as we could, but again, the positions had to be created. We ran a small surplus while that was happening. And again, we have this very happy and unanticipated surplus because of our law clerk's maternity leave.
Okay, any questions? No questions. Any public testimony? Seeing none, the bill will be held over for possible inclusion, House File 1703. Thank you, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you.
Now we have Representative Albright, 1677.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Representative Albright's bill is going. The chair will move House File 1677 to pass and refer to the General Register, and you have a DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if you could move that to put the bill in the shape that I would like to speak to.
Chair will move the DE1 amendment for the author to get it in the bill shape he would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, Representative Albright, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This bill has been heard in the Senate and over on that side of the legislature is now on general orders. This is the bill's third hearing in the House. This bill is part of the larger Minnesota Department of Human Services policy bill, House File 1535, that's been offered by Representative Mack. There are certain sections of the bill that are of particular interest to this committee today. Before stepping through those sections and concurrent with the adoption of the amendment, I would like to speak to the bill itself. The amendment that we just passed on to the bill relates to child welfare and the penalties for fraudulent activity on food assistance and child care programs. With that being said, I do have two folks from the Department of Human Services to describe the changes in the sections and to be available to answer any questions that the committee members might have. And with that, I'll turn over to my testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Okay, ma'am, if you give us your name and organization and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nikki Farrago, and I'm from the Department of Human Services. So I will be going over the child welfare provisions that Representative Albright mentioned that are in the DE amendment.
No, Representative Gilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you get too far, I literally just heard this bill like less than an hour ago in civil law, and supposedly the pieces were spun out and sent to the proper committees. But I noticed that the crime provision that was in the MAC bill is not in this amendment. So does that mean you're deleting out the additional and new crime, or does that mean that you have inadvertently not sent it to the Public Safety Committee where we hear all about crime?
Go ahead, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, If you could specify which section you're referring to.
That's what I'm looking for, the sections that they were crimes related to SNAP and related to, are they in this new DE amendment?
Oh, sir, your name and title, and to answer that question if you could.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services, Inspector General's Office, and those two sections Representative Hillstrom is interested in are sections 34 and 35, and I'll be talking about those next.
Okay. I just want to make sure that all the pieces made it in here. Thank you.
Okay, ma'am, go ahead with your testimony again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I am here to cover the child welfare provisions that are in the DE amendment. Just to provide some orientation, those are sections 2, 3, 5, 10 through 32, and 36.
Okay, go ahead.
So all these provisions relate to Indian child welfare. This proposal gets to the stark disparities that American Indian families and children face, particularly related to out-of-home placement. American Indian children are 15 and a half times more likely to be placed out of the home than a white child in Minnesota. And Minnesota actually has the highest disparity in the country related to this. Minnesota has a couple of pieces of legislation that do help get to these disparities, the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. But we continue to see some inconsistency and lack of compliance across the state. So these provisions are meant to increase compliance with those acts and provide some clarifying language. The tribes worked with the counties and DHS, so county attorneys, the county social service agencies. This was about a 9-month process where people were digging in really hard and coming to some language that everybody agreed to, and that's what you see before you today. The changes are categorized into about 4 different categories. There are establishment of new definitions and amendments to other definitions. There is establishment of a purpose statement in the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act that underscores the importance of the law. It clarifies requirements, and it also mandates compliance with the Indian Family Preservation Act throughout the child welfare proceedings. And I'm happy to go into any detail and stand for any questions. But that concludes the child welfare provision.
Yeah, I don't see any questions yet. The next testifier, thank you very much, ma'am.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'd like to go through Section 34 and 35 of this bill, of the Delete Everything Amendment. In Section 34, we're creating a new offense, and what we're dealing with in this case is what we're finding through our investigations, and we're finding through communication with a lot of county employees who are trying to do job placement activity for people in the child care assistance program. What we hear from them is that we have this child care assistance program that's intended to give folks a leg up on becoming independent and having meaningful employment. As they're involved in this program, we fund their child care so that the children can get quality child care and be ready for kindergarten. What we're learning as we go through some of our investigations is that there are employers who are recruiting individuals based on the number of children they have who they believe to be eligible for the child care assistance program. And then once they have those people enrolled in the child care assistance program and they have used this employment with the child care provider to gain that enrollment in the program, then the arrangement is that they ask the employees to stay home and take care of their kids at home. What they do is they give them some phony paycheck stubs to share with the counties to verify, seemingly verify that they are employed, but then pay them a smaller amount of cash just to stay home. This is a recurring theme that we see, and what we're wanting to do in this case is to make that an actual offense. We know that making employment decisions based on family status or based on public assistance status is a violation of the Human Rights Act, but it's only a civil offense, and so there are no criminal penalties for that. So what we're trying to do here is to make that a criminal offense that would be sentenced according, you know, similar to other public assistance crimes under 609.52. What we see here is that there are a number of victims involved, and that gives rise to our belief that it ought to be an offense in and of itself. Certainly the children are being denied quality child care. These children are not likely then to be taking advantage of this quality opportunity they have to be ready for kindergarten. And we know that the earlier kids can get involved in educational systems, the more likely they are to succeed. We know that the parents are being deprived of the opportunity that's available through this public program to get a leg up on independence because they're not really engaged in any kind of meaningful employment that's going to help them with further jobs, because we also hear that upon their children aging out from the child care assistance eligibility, they're terminated. And so there they are left with nothing, and they've learned no job skills. The third group, of course, are the 5,600 families on the waiting list to get in the child care assistance program who may have meaningful employment, and they're being denied in this process. And then finally, you know, the victims are all taxpayers, and there's an investment in this program, an investment in these families. And we've all heard the Art Rolnick research results that shows that for every dollar invested in quality early childhood education, there's a reward of $8 in return. And so when individuals are engaging in this fraudulent activity, they're not only stealing the investment that's being made by Minnesota, but they're also stealing the reward, the return on that. And so we're proposing that this be an offense that's sentenceable at all the different levels according to 609.52.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kerber, so it would be sentenced based on the value or the dollar amount that they have taken from the program, is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, that's exactly right. So that sort of punctuates the fact that this crime is always going to be accompanying another. And when we reviewed this with the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines to see what they thought about whether there was going to be a significant cost to this in terms of incarceration, they said, well, no, because this really won't be a standalone offense. And so the way it's actually being amended does tie it to there has to have been some dollar amount of fraudulent activity that's occurred that then is used for purposes of the sentencing.
Representative Hilsman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is actually making the business owner or operator responsible as well for the assistance fraud, whereas previously it just would have been the parent who was applying for the funds that would have been. Is that what you're getting at here?
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, that's certainly what we're trying to do here, is to make it much more clear that this is an offense by this organization. And this in no way or shape or form affects the families and their eligibility. The goal here would be that those families would actually be getting the child care assistance that we're funding, that they're getting quality child care from some other provider, but we want to intervene more effectively at stopping this by the employer themselves. Yes, and it's a little weak right now in terms of prosecuting those folks.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so if the person who is doing the child care assistance knowingly is participating, doing this does not do anything to the county's ability to prosecute the person who actually has the children and who was knowingly participating in this fraud. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, certainly there's some collaboration in some of these efforts. This doesn't change the sort of what's available already to prosecute an individual for, you know, public assistance fraud. We're not changing that in any way. Those laws exist, and that seems to be adequate at this point anyway. What we're trying to really do is to go after that provider.
Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so you already have the ability to go after their license for this kind of behavior, or I see that this is all just criminal. Is there someplace else that participating in this kind of crime then also causes their license to actually do this kind of business to put it in jeopardy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, yes. And, in fact, there's another provision of the policy bill that wasn't we didn't understand was of interest in this committee. But there is one that makes it much more clear that if somebody has a conviction for this kind of activity, it does impact their child care license.
Okay, any other questions? Any other testimony? Public testimony. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is he going to talk about the financial transaction card fraud piece that starts on page 30, or did he already do that, and should I ask my questions about that now?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, that was the next section that I was going to mention. That this is what this is doing is making it more clear in Minnesota criminal statutes that SNAP or food stamp fraud is also a crime here. This language mirrors federal requirements, and so it brings our Minnesota statutes in line with federal statutes, and just makes it more clear that any kind of trafficking that goes on regarding SNAP benefit cards is also a crime in Minnesota.
Okay, is that it?
Mr. Chair, those are my sections, yes.
Okay, any other sections, or did you have any other testimony, Representative? And any public testimony, anybody here? Okay, without any questions, the chair would move House File 1677 as amended to pass and refer to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Owen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Now, Representative Simonson, House File 1940.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Committee.
Morning, Representative Simonson. We've got, I'll move House File 1940 to pass and refer to the General Register. No amendments, so go ahead, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I will be brief, and I just have two testifiers, perhaps one testifier, but maybe two, but we will all be very brief in the interest of the pressure of the day. House File 1940, members, is a pretty straightforward bill. Its sole purpose is to have a school bus specifically mentioned in the trespass law as school property and further not allowing unauthorized individuals to board the bus without the bus driver's permission. Exceptions are made in the bill for students, for school personnel, and volunteers who are authorized to be on the bus. The penalty for violation of this proposed change in the law would not exceed that of current trespass laws as they relate to other types of school property. We think this is a reasonable measure that would help ensure student and bus driver safety going forward. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would turn it over to the testifier.
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jan Vanderwall, Transportation Director, Roseville School District, and also member of Minnesota Association of Pupil Transportation. We've in Roseville schools in the last 5 years, we've had incidents that this bill would have assisted us with. We had a parent who was unhappy with the driver over some things. Our procedures in the district are that the parents bring that to the school district and we rectify it. In this case, the parent got on the bus with the driver and we had to take further action to get him off the bus. We've also had parents that get on buses upset with what other students may have done with their child, and as we're all very much aware, our bus driver is there to protect our kids, make sure they're safe, and doesn't know when a person gets on the bus what their intentions are, may not know, and we certainly need to have a further remedy beyond just saying that in our board policies that they can't get on the bus. This would be helpful to us.
Okay, Representative Simonson, you have another
trooper want to testify? We have one more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Lieutenant Brian with the State Patrol. I think Representative Simonson and Mr. VanWalt did a good job of explaining the bill, so I'll stand for any questions that you may have for me on the law enforcement side of things.
Members, do we have any questions? Representative Howell.
When the, I guess the only question I have, Mr. Chair, is when they ask him to the parent or whatever, or whoever's on there to leave, is there any parental control to take that student or that their child off with them? I mean, I guess, you know, I have a little bit of tendency that if my child or my grandchild would be on that bus and I think they're getting bullied or something, that I would be able to get on there and take my child off or my grandchild off to protect them. I mean, I can understand being ordered to get off, and I'm supportive of that, but can they take their child or grandchild with them when they leave?
Lieutenant, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, and members. Some of that falls into a policy issue with the school and how they handle it, but essentially, if a parent was trying to take a student out of school, they would have to sign their child out. The child is basically the ward of the school or the district at that point for their protection. And bus drivers and districts are only allowed to disload students or unload students at authorized and approved stops set forth by the district and the school board. So if there was a case where a parent needed to get a child off the bus, they should go through the transportation director and the school district to say, hey, I need my kid off the bus for this reason, and work it out with them versus addressing it with the school bus driver.
In other words, the lieutenant, we might run into a problem. The bus driver not know who the parents are, and it could be in a divorce situation or not even have custody of the kid and try to jerk him off the bus. Probably it would be a problematic. Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simonson. So I see the clause number C, and it says subdivision does not apply to a child, school employee, or volunteer authorized to be on the school bus. So I'm assuming it's only a child that's authorized to be on the school bus. So if a child from another school came on and got on the bus, they would then also be trespassing?
Lieutenant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative members. Yes, that is how it reads.
Okay. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Simonson. I appreciate the significance of this. My question is really about the communications and certainly through the school boards and that sort of thing and in the policy manuals. Will there also be something like a sign on the bus, on the window of the bus, so that says something about who's authorized to be on, so that perhaps it kind of preempts something, that the bus driver doesn't actually have to educate people as they go along? Just communicating with families is a real challenge. And as much as I appreciate this, I'm just concerned about the implementation and the communication of the change.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, you know, that's a great question, and it really comes down to the individual school district and how they want to communicate that and how they want to address that. But I can tell you from personal experience, and I'm guessing that the testifier would support this, that school districts do a really good job of communicating with the parents about the rules and the conduct expected both on school property and now under this bill, which would include the school bus. And drivers and managers of the driver, they want some clarity, and they support this bill because it's not that drivers want to throw people off the bus and charge them with trespassing. What they want to do is provide a safe environment for the children. So I think that, you know, the prudent school district will do everything they can to communicate, and, you know, signage is always a potential option for them, but it's up to the individual district.
Okay, any questions? Any further testimony before I call for public testimony?
No, Mr. Chair.
Any public testimony? If not, the Chair would renew the motion for House File 1940 to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you, Representative Simons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And now, Representative Slocum, House File 1825. I'm Representative Hillstrom. I've been kind of doing a bully pulpit here on the referrals. Anytime you folks want to refer a bill of your own members, just jump in there. So, sorry about that.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know if you've been skipping Representative Green's bill because it was previously controversial. It's my understanding that they've cut a deal, and although we don't have language for your committee, it's my understanding that there is peace on the bill. So whenever you're ready on that bill, Mr. Chair.
Yep, I think that was my understanding, too. They just happened to come out on the bottom of the pile. So, Representative Slocum, go ahead. I'll move your bill, House File 1825, to pass and refer to the Tax Committee. And you have a author's amendment, the A150351.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an author's amendment.
Okay, I'll move your A150351 to get in the shape you'd like it. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Go ahead to your bill as amended.
Okay. First, let me just say, Mr. Chair, I miss this committee. I do. This was always a fun one, and look at, you always have a standing room only crowd. Yeah. Pretty exciting. House file 1825 makes illegal and imposes penalties for the design, development, sale, or possession of computer software that alters and creates fraudulent accounting records for businesses. The computer software called Zappers suppresses recorded sales, so a business appears to have fewer or lesser sales than they actually do. The result of this fraud is that the business appears to owe the state less sales tax. Currently, Minnesota has no law against sales suppression Zapper software. This bill will help the Department of Revenue ensure that businesses are not creating, or not, whoops, cheating by not paying the appropriate sales tax. And just for your information, we're not talking petty change here. The National Restaurant Association estimates a tax loss in Minnesota of $41,200,000 from 9,767 restaurants, and an estimated loss of $17.8 million from Minnesota convenience stores using this tax evasion software, Zappers. This takes money away from our law-abiding, hard-working Minnesotans. Please vote to stop this cheating, basically, and support this bill. I'm also supposed to tell you that when we read this in Commerce, when we ran the bill in Commerce, Representative Davids jumped up and down, got very excited, and said, make me a co-author and call it the Slocum-Davids bill. So if it helps, I'm willing.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. Which testifier would you like to start?
Okay, I have Paul Cummins. Coming first, he's got a PowerPoint to tell you a little bit about the Zappers. We will move quickly. And then I have Margaret Riesdorf to answer questions that have to do with legality.
How long is your PowerPoint, sir?
4 hours.
I think it's like 4 or 5 slides. We just wanted to show you some pictures, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and give us your name and organization and begin, sir.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummins, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. First of all, I wanted to thank Representative Slocum for, I almost demoted you.
I know, please.
thank you to Representative Slocum for carrying this important legislation. And thank you to you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to come before you as a resource. This legislation makes it unlawful for persons to sell, purchase, install, transfer, possess, or access, or use tax evasion software designed to falsify sales tax record to avoid remitting of collected sales tax. This tax evasion software is sold factory installed on point of sale machines or registered, sold separately. It's also sold as a cloud-based service. So what is a sales suppression device, sometimes called a zapper? It is a computer function that facilitates tax evasion. The sales suppression can be facilitated through flash drives, removable CDs, or access through the internet. It allows businesses to avoid remitting sales tax and income tax on deleted or reduced receipts. And I'll give you an example of the receipts in just a second. In these cases, businesses retain sales tax collected from their customers. In other states, we found that businesses with customers that pay for more of their transactions in cash are the highest users of the software. In these situations, some businesses create two sets of books, while others remove the sales data from all records. So, Mr. Chair, I wanted to show you a zapped receipt. So what we have on the right-hand side is a real receipt, something that the consumer would find if they are that they would receive after a transaction. So this receipt would come from the till, and you'd find that there's a bunch of items, and the subtotal is $45. There's a tax of $4.35 for a total of a little over $50. And what would happen through the Zapper technology is that between the time that this receipt came out and the time in which that was remitted to the Department of Revenue, the software would zap transactions so that there would be less taxable sales in a zapped or modified receipt. So as you can see, the transactions are moved, so all of the lunch combos have been moved to the price of iced coffees for a subtotal of much less, $20. The tax on $20 is a little less than $2 for a total of $22.39. So, Mr. Chair, there, what you'll see is that sales tax is collected from consumers, but then between the time of this trust tax being given to the person, to the retailer, and the time in which it's sent to the Department of Revenue, there's money that has been collected from consumers but not remitted to the state. In a 2009 New York sting operation, 22 of 23 salespeople selling point-of-sale systems like cash registers to a retailer offered the retailer sales suppression devices, software, or services without prompting. So, Mr. Chair, if I could, I just wanted to share with you a little bit from that sting operation.
A little bit.
Mr. Chair, so the potential purchaser of the software said, and you'll still delete our files for us, even though you know it will be destroying original evidence. The purchaser went on to say, you'll delete our files knowing that this is evidence the tax authorities will be looking for. The salesman said, of course, of course. I just need you to know that it's not a problem for me. It's your choice. There's no law that says you have to keep original point-of-sale system records. There's nothing that says that. So, Mr. Chair, something that Representative Slocum talked about is there is a revenue loss in the state due to sales tax that are collected but not remitted due to the sales suppression software. I wanted to turn it over to Ms. Reisdorf to talk a little bit about more what's going on in other states and the history.
Go ahead, ma'am, with your name and organization.
Chair Cornish, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Reisdorf, and I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And really where all this began was actually in the province of Quebec in 2002. In 2002, that province estimated, now they have a different tax system than we do, so they're able to track inputs as well as outputs out of business a little bit more readily than we are. But they estimated that over 50% of restaurants were zapping sales, and that sort of embarked sort of the research into this. That province criminalized the behavior with language very similar to what we have here in House File 1825, and they also put in some other enforcement measures as far as audit and using different technology, leading to the fact that in 2012-2011, sales tax revenues in the restaurant sector went up by $160 million in 1 year. So their research actually led to the state of Georgia in 2011 to enact the first sales suppression legislation. And as you can see from this map, we now have 20 states that have all kind of have about very substantially similar legislation enacted. And that's the same language upon which this legislation has been based. Essentially what we're trying to do here is create a criminal penalty for the sale, the development, the use, the access, the provision of sales suppression services, so that we can do what other states have done, and what they feel it's been most effective is that it chills the selling of this software. We do know that in the marketplace, it's the point of sale vendors who are making these services and or software available, and in other jurisdictions, they found that this type of legislation has had a very profound chilling effect on that activity. Other states that have experience with this, my colleague, Mr. Cummings, mentioned the New York sting operations. There have also been investigations in the state of Connecticut in the Stew Leonard Dairy grocery store chain, as well as in Michigan with the Lashish restaurant chain, and in the state of Ohio with the International House of Pancakes.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Any questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know who might be able to answer this. So in your testimony, Mr. Cummings, you had mentioned in the sting operation this person doing the sales saying there's nothing in the law that requires you to keep your original point of sale receipts. Do we have anything in our law that requires folks to keep their point of sale receipts?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, we certainly do. In Minnesota Rules 8130-7500, I forget which subpart, but in that rule, we do require original records.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slocum, question I have, it deals with the equipment itself. I know that there's a lot of restaurants and that end up going out of business, and their equipment is sold on auction, or these warehouse places, they buy up the equipment. They might not know this technology is in these systems. What happens to the when somebody buys the stuff and it's in there and they have no idea? Are they going to get charged with this, or is there any protections for that in this bill?
Go ahead, ma'am.
Representative Chair Cornish, Representative, with the new amendment, the only way a person would be charged is if they know it is going to be used to either zap or suppress sales for tax fraud, so they would not be liable. And in addition, a law-abiding retailer, they would know, because I don't know if we can go back to the receipt screen, but as you notice on the receipt screen, that the ticket number remains the same, but the information or the totals are different. Any responsible retailer would run reports and they would notice the discrepancy. But in any event, this legislation would not reach that.
Okay, I think we've got a Representative Johnson and then Neuberger and then O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, there's a lot of times that the book that the people running the tills, they don't get to see what's run up. That goes to the bookkeeper. The bookkeeper don't see the receipts that went out with the customer. How are you going to verify the two? Because the person that you said is not seeing the same receipts. So I think there might be a little bit of problem we need to work out to make sure that an unintended victim isn't charged, especially if they're buying the used equipment. Because the bookkeepers are the ones that do the stuff, figure out the taxes. They do not receive these receipts because it's a generated report on the computer that sends the amount that taxes is owed.
Chair Cornish, Representative, again, this legislation would only criminalize knowing behavior.
Okay, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slocum, maybe one of your testifiers can answer this, but I don't think I caught this part. What do you estimate, how much have you lost? How many millions of dollars have you not recovered? Your best guess on this, what's this costing us?
Who'd like to answer that? Representative Slocum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, it is estimated that we have lost, and this is an estimation by the National Restaurant Association, $41.2 million from 9,767 retailers, restaurant owners, and then $17.8 million from Minnesota convenience stores. So it's a significant amount of money we're losing out on.
Representative Neuberger.
Just a real quick follow-up. Over what kind of a time period are we looking?
I believe that's a year. Mr. Chair, excuse me. I believe that's a year.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask some of the same type of questions. And I actually used to work at a CPA firm helping clients go through sales tax audits, so I know this a little bit. And Mr. Cummings and I have talked about this a bit. But, you know, just looking at your example of receipts, pretty sure that if one of your auditors came in and saw a receipt that had a chicken sandwich on it with no dollar amount, that would be a red flag immediately. So, yeah. Mr. Cummings, do you have a sense as to, I know you said about $60 million, but with all the auditors, I know that you're very closely tied with all your auditors and know what they're up to, and you have those conversations because we talked about that in my office.
Yep.
So do you have any any numbers as far as the information coming back from Minnesota auditors, from your department, not just from the Retailer Association, not just from Restaurant Association, as far as what you are finding from your auditors when they actually go and do sales tax audits? Because if that's really the receipt they show your auditors, I guarantee you that that's going to be a red flag, because that just doesn't pass the muster there.
Mr. Chair, I think you're right, Representative O'Neill, that we have found anecdotes of this happening, and the information that we quoted was from the National Restaurant Association. So we are finding various anecdotes. When we went, there were a few tax administrators that went to the Midwest Association of Tax Administrators, and there was a conversation about this. There are various ways that you can look specifically at this type of behavior through various audits. Some that are referenced in various parts. Quebec did something that I don't think that we would do, which is require sales recording devices on every machine. But but as it relates to trying to figure out, should we take a more targeted approach at trying to look at this behavior, or should we come up with some penalties in order to put a chilling effect on what should be done first? Everyone said that the best approach to do that was to put a penalty on. So we do see this come up in audit at various times, but it is anecdotal, and it is also not, because it's something emerging, it's something that we're looking for, but we don't have a targeted approach on it. I don't know if that answered your question, Representative O'Neill.
Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, that doesn't really answer the question, because I know that the Department of Revenue is very thorough, that your auditors look at receipts, because I've been on the other end of it.
Yep.
And I've gone through this process myself. So I know that your auditors are looking at all those receipts. I've talked to many of my restaurants in my district, and they take hours and days to go through a year, 2 years, sometimes 3 years, depending on how they decide to do the audit, of individual receipts that look just like this. And I'm guessing that with all of the audits that your auditors were doing, and when I was working in that field, I was told by one of your auditors that their goal was to audit every single small business in the state of Minnesota every 3 years. And so my anecdotal in my district is, yes, in fact, that is happening. I've heard different things from your district, from your revenue department since then. But I do know that you are out there, you're looking at restaurants that, if anybody knows really what's happening in Minnesota, the Department of Revenue does. Now, you talked about New York, you've talked about California, you've talked about other places, but I think before we move ahead, we really need to know what is the prevalence here in Minnesota, not just from the retailers, not just from the Restaurant Association, but from you, the Department of Revenue, saying, our auditors have gotten in, we've looked at this, we know that this is actually happening, not anecdotally, but actually, I know that if it's actually happening in Minnesota, your auditors will know it, because you're out there. You're out there a lot. And so I want to know from the Department of Revenue how much prevalence have your auditors found in this actual, is this really happening in Minnesota, or is this just happening in New York, like this thing that you talked about, or in California or other states, but what's happening here?
If you could give us a quick answer, we've got another bill left in 20 minutes, so go ahead. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to go too far out on a limb about disclosure issues related to what we have found or what's under investigation related to this type of behavior, but there is no business reason for having the software. I don't want to go out on a limb that I can't get back from as it relates to disclosure.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Any other testimony? Public testimony? If not, the chair will move House File 1825 as amended to pass and refer to taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you very much, Reverend Zolkin. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
Okay.
Would reconsider?
Was there a, I didn't call for any
call for objection.
Should we reconsider and do it right?
Yeah. Why don't we, just to make it official here, we'll move to reconsider House File 1825, because I didn't ask for opposing votes. Motion to reconsider House File 1825. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, and now the chair will renew his motion for House File 1825 to pass and refer to taxes as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry about that. Representative Green, welcome. House File 1935. Chair will move House File 1935 to pass and refer to the General Register. And you have two author's amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Chair will move them separately here first to get them into the shape that you want your bill. Chair will move the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. And the chair will move then the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The two amendments carried. And Representative Green, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I think there was one other small author's oral amendment. And it would be on line 1.7. Do you guys have that?
1.7 of the bill or the one of the
amendment? Of the A2 amendment.
Okay. 1.7, where at?
It would be deleting offering to provide and replacing it with providing.
Research, could you folks just restate that amendment, what he's doing there?
Mr. Chair, members, this is to the A2 amendment on line 1.7. Delete offering to provide and insert providing.
Representative Hillstrom, are you okay with that late amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Then the chair will offer that oral amendment as heard, the A2. Everybody understand it? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carried. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 1935 was brought to me by representatives from Fond du Lac and Mille Lacs, and it addresses some issues they have with some things that have been going on up there. The bill is now supported by the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe and also the JRLC, so it's the Joint Religious Leadership Council. And the bill does represent a compromise now between the proponents of the bill and the medical examining community, examiner community. They are on board. So the bill is apparently right now acceptable to everybody who is concerned. I do have four testifiers, and if it would be possible, Mr. Chair, to allow, because of the time, if they would be able to testify before we take questions, that would be great.
Sure. Go ahead, sir, with your name and organization and begin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tad Johnson. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and I'm also an attorney. I'm going to really summarize my remarks. I'm very glad that we have reached some compromise language here that everybody agrees upon. So I'm just going to limit it to this came out of a very bad incident where an American Indian man died. He practiced the traditional Ojibwe religion of Madewin, which is not too well known outside of the Native American community. Part of their belief system is that the body, after it passes, is not to be desecrated in any way, and an autopsy under their belief system is a desecration. So consequently, his widow is here with me, and she has a statement to provide. But the essence of the story is that another attorney and I went and got a court order to stop the autopsy. A judge allowed the autopsy, allowed us to not have the autopsy, and for the family to get the body back. It wasn't clear to the medical examiner or the county attorney or the sheriff once that autopsy statute kicked in, if the body could be retrieved, even with a court order. So there was a vagueness in the law. We trust that this amendment that represented this to the law that Representative Green has provided will clarify the law, allow people to object if they have sincerely held religious beliefs. It provides for a balancing test, but it also, if there's a compelling state interest that the medical examiners have, and we spent exhaustive hours with medical examiners finding out exactly what their interests were, and it's now they're in the bill. So with that, I will pass it on to Mr. Ovid's widow, and she has a brief statement.
Oh. And we didn't mean to hurry along, ma'am, though if you want to give your full statement, go ahead. We don't too worried about hanging on for a few minutes. We didn't mean to rush you because it is an important bill with religious background. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Winnie LaPrairie Mushkoob. I'm an enrolled member of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Ojibwe. I've lived the majority of my life on the Mille Lacs Band, Ojibwe, in East Lake, Minnesota. First, I'd like to say thank you to all of you that are here, and thank you to Senator Tony Lowry and Representative Green for their work on this legislation. And I'd like to say thank you to the chairman and to all of you that are here today for allowing me to say a few words about this bill. I am the wife of Mushkoob, a Mille Lacs Band member. He was a drum keeper. He was a spiritual elder. He was educated, and he was a good man and father and husband. All my life, I believed in following the rules and state laws of, the state of Minnesota, the U.S., the county, the township. And I was the first American Indian woman in the state of Minnesota to be a union journeywoman carpenter. I worked on the reservation in Fond du Lac building houses in the 1980s. I worked here in Minneapolis. I worked on over 600 houses. Then I went on to go into semi-retirement and had a baby there. And now I'm a retired teacher. I just want to say that, as a Native woman, I've experienced a lot of racism in my life, in schools, grocery stores all over the state. And, I always believed in rules and the rules of the law. I always believed that our system of justice exists to protect the rights of less fortunate, and that the law is colorblind. But my confidence in our judicial system was shaken the night of my husband's death, when I learned that some people with power are above the law. When Tad Johnson told me that he had a court order signed by a judge ordering the immediate release of my husband's body, but yet I still could not take him home, I was heartbroken. I couldn't understand how one man couldn't ignore a court order. And I still don't understand. It took 10 hours and two county attorneys before we could take my husband home. I know people here are sorry for what happened to my family. I listened to other hearings. I know that Dr. Baker said this would never happen down here in southern Minnesota, and that our family would not have been treated this way. He said that this was an isolated case because most medical examiners do not believe this way, behave this way, excuse me. But the fact is, no matter what any of you here think or say, there is still a medical examiner operating in four counties in northern Minnesota who believes court orders do not apply to him. There are still county attorneys and sheriffs in northern Minnesota who think he might be right. People's religious rights might be protected here in the cities, but what about rights of my family in northern Minnesota? Dr. Baker might respect the dignity of grieving families, but what about the dignity of Native people hundreds of miles away? Who is protecting us and looking out for us? Because that night, nobody with power was. Not the medical examiner, not the county attorney, not the sheriff. The judge tried, but his court order was ignored, and nobody would enforce it. We stood outside in the freezing cold without restrooms and treated like second-class citizens. I ask you to pass this legislation because Native people and all communities of color need to know our rights are just as important as yours. I ask that you pass this legislation so that every medical examiner in Minnesota knows they are not above the law, and every county attorney and sheriff is clear that they must enforce the law. I watched this happen to my family. And then 2 days later, I watched it happen to another Native family on my reservation. Please change the law now, because everything that my family went through could happen tomorrow or to someone else. Please don't let this happen. Don't let that happen. Please prove to us we are not second-class citizens. Miigwech, and thank you for allowing me to speak here. And I am my first time here, and thank you very much for allowing me to speak, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, ma'am. It was a very stirring testimony. It got very quiet in the room when you were talking. Everybody was listening. Representative Quam, followed by Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Miigwech. And this reminds us that it's the people that the laws are for, not the other way around. And again, Miigwech.
Representative Green, I forgot to ask if there's any more testimony before we took questions.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there are two medical examiner and county attorney associations.
Is it okay if we wait with questions until? Okay, go ahead. Sir, if you could state your name and organization and begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Baker. I do not represent any unit of government nor any official organization here today. Would you like me to begin?
Yes.
I am a medical examiner, and the prepared remarks I have represent the collective thoughts of the chief medical examiners of Minnesota's largest counties. As I said earlier, I'm not here representing any government entity or any organization in Minnesota. I'm here to support this bill and to represent to you the medical examiner community's support. I am deeply sorry for the families and the community at large at the center of the controversy that sparked this outrage. Though this will be no consolation to those families, our elected leaders should know that what happened to those families in our careers and in our offices was unimaginable and without precedent. Excuse me. With regard to the statutory change you are considering, we recognize the concessions made by all sides, and we medical examiners support the bill as it stands now. The supporters of this bill were willing to meet with the medical examiner community, and in the time we had, they accepted many suggestions from the medical examiners and were willing to incorporate them. We are grateful to the bill's proponents for their willingness to do this. Given legitimate and heartfelt concerns of all the stakeholders, we recognize this bill as the best legislative compromise that will allow medical examiners the latitude to perform their duties while simultaneously ensuring that no families have their religious freedoms unnecessarily infringed upon by the state without the opportunity for recourse and relief. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Another testifier, and then when the testifiers are done, maybe we can take some questions, unless somebody wants to ask the testifier that comes up. So. Mr. Small, is it? Go ahead with your name and organization and begin.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Small, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. On behalf of the County Attorneys Association, we certainly want to extend our condolences to the families that experienced this situation and the apologies of all our members for the negative experiences that they went through, particularly during a time of grief. Thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to testify about this bill. It's been reviewed by our board of directors. And since this matter was heard in the Civil Law Committee on Monday, we have had the opportunity to meet with the proponents of this bill and have had very helpful and productive conversations. For the most part, we have reached agreement on a number of issues. And while we are supportive of this bill going forward, there remain parts of it that we are still working on with the proponents, and I think it might be helpful and important for you to know what those things are, so I'd like to walk through them with you. As a result of our meetings, we've reached agreement on many, many issues. We have agreed that this bill provides the process by which judicial review may be obtained, and that that process should therefore be exempt from the processes set forth in Chapter 14 of our statutes, which is commonly referred to as the Administrative Procedures Act. We are in agreement with the proponents on that, and we recommend that language be included that exempts this from the Administrative Procedures Act. Secondly, in what is now Subdivision 2B, Parent G, it discusses who may object to the autopsy on religious grounds. And we have reached an agreement with the proponents that there needs to be a cross-reference to Minnesota Statute 149A.80 to clarify the priority of persons who may object. So, for example, if the surviving spouse of the decedent does not have a religious objection to the autopsy, then the autopsy may be performed without further delay, notwithstanding a person of lower priority under the statute having a religious objection. This was intended and has been articulated earlier in the bill, but warrants extra clarity in that particular section as well. Thirdly, we have agreed that there are certain instances in which the disclosure of information during the course of these proceedings outlined in the bill would compromise an ongoing criminal investigation. and that the confidentiality of the information presented to the court would be essential. For example, if there was a death that would fall within those provisions now in Section 2BG, and the person who is raising the religious objection is the suspect in the death, then to prematurely disclose that information would be detrimental to the ongoing investigation. We further agreed that we can draw on a process that is used in other situations to accomplish this task of keeping the information confidential, yet having it reviewed by the judge. That process is what's called the prosecutor's certificate, and in those situations, for example, the prosecutor could disclose a list of names or pieces of evidence, the early release of which would compromise the safety of those witnesses. The judge then reviews that information with the affidavit of the prosecutor and makes a judgment about whether or not that information should remain confidential for the time being. So we're calling on that same process and would have a comparable process known as a medical examiner certificate, which would be able to give the information to the judge, allow the judge to decide whether or not to keep that information temporarily confidential. To be clear, the same showing would have to be made, but it is a determination of whether the showing contains information that should be protected, and that should have a special process. There is agreement on that. We just have not had time to draft the specific language of what that medical examiner certification language would look like. Fourthly, we've had agreement that there needs to be a standard for the court to apply in ruling on a petition that would come before the judge. As you look at section what is now 2B parent G, there is currently a weighing test contemplated. We believe, and there is agreement, that we should have a more of a regular standard of review that would be familiar to both the attorneys as well as to the judge handling the process. We are still doing some research on what that particular language would be and have not yet agreed as to what that standard would be.
Mr. Small? I just want to say, if any of the members have anything pressing they got to get to, it's not. I don't think it's going to be a controversial bill. We'll have enough votes. So if anybody has to skip out and go to something, you know, okay, Mr. Small, go ahead.
All right, thank you very much. I'll try to move on quickly. But the association would think that the standard of review familiar to both lawyers and judges would be a reasonable suspicion that might be able to be articulated to the judge. That would be, in our view, a particularly appropriate standard when investigating suspected crime. The proponents, I'm sure, would like a higher standard, and we agree that there should be a standard. We just are continuing to work on what that standard should be, and we are pleased to be working with the proponents to resolve this issue. Lastly, we agreed with the proponents that more comfort language might be included in one portion, particularly that on line, what's now 2BA1I, and that would be adding suspicious deaths to that language. So in conclusion, we look forward to continuing discussions with the proponents. They've been very fruitful, and we look forward to making additional progress on the areas that I just mentioned, and we do support the bill going forward.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Small.
Thank you.
If there's no questions, any more testifiers, Representative Green?
Nope, that shouldn't be it.
The Representative Howe had one question on the language, but this has already been through civil law data practices.
Yes.
He had a question on the on line 4.31 on page 4, where it says maintained indefinitely in the language there. But this is already passed through civil law and data practices. Yeah. Do you have any problem with that, Representative Hilston? Okay.
Okay. Any questions? We've got a list here of, see if I'm right, Representative Howe, Considine, and Zerwas. Representative Howe is gone. Representative, who's the list I'm looking at? Considine and then Zerwas. And then there's a Johnson in here, too. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First to the testifier, I'm so sorry for the indignities that were forced upon you. That's appalling. My question is how the hell did it happen a second time?
Mr. Chair?
Is that a statement or a question? Or? Okay. How did it happen a second time, you said?
The testifier mentioned that 2 days later it happened to another family. Okay. And I guess I think maybe the county attorney might be the, or, okay, there. Somebody tell me how it happened a second time.
Could you give your name again? And your
yes, my name is Tad Johnson. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and I'm an attorney. Mr. Chairman, sir, the first incidents occurred over the weekend, and Mr. Abbott died as a result of a heart condition. The second occurrence happened in the middle of the following week, and it was a young lady from 24-year-old young lady from the Fond du Lac Reservation, and she was struck and killed immediately as a passenger in a car. And once again, the same medical examiner came and once again did not talk to the family and once again brought police in. And once again, this time she brought one of the police officers said, "Where you have to tell the family where you're taking the body, because they were going to take the body and autopsy it." And she begrudgingly told them they're taking it to Hibbing, and said, "If you guys can taking her to Hibbing, and if you're going to get a court order, you have to do it within an hour." That family suffered several indignities as well. We have representatives from the Fond du Lac Reservation here, but since we had Mr. Abbott's widow, we thought we would allow her to proceed. But this got a tremendous amount of play in the northern Minnesota press. And actually, these two incidents are why we're here today, because what was not clear to the Carlton County Attorney, the St. Louis County Attorney, the county sheriffs, and the medical examiners was whether or not a court order applied to them. And the same judge did both orders, and it took a call the first time from two county attorneys to the medical examiner to request that he release the body. Second time, the Carlton County Attorney ended up calling the medical examiner and requesting the release of the body. And so we want it to be made clear that people have a right to go into court, object to these things, and everybody wanted, including the medical examiners, the county attorneys, everybody involved, the families, was the possibility of getting a day in court to object. And so this bill will provide that opportunity. And so it was a kind of a bizarre coincidence. They both happened in the same week.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, my sincere condolences to the family that went through this. I want to say a little bit of why what the importance of an autopsy is. Now, we've never discussed that. I'm going to bring up two situations that I was involved in. First one was a car accident. Just two people's involved. One person was killed in the accident. The person that survived where the accident ended up, and it looked like it had occurred and was in the wrong lane, that person was going to get charged with vehicular homicide. But there was an autopsy done on the victim. Turned out that person, when the crash occurred, had already been deceased from a heart attack and was not in control of the vehicle. And the person that was going to get charged with vehicular homicide, because of the autopsy, was not. And that person was the actual victim in this, and she was trying to avoid the car that was out of control. That's one very important thing for the reason we do autopsies. And we do death investigations very seriously, not knowing if it's a natural death, a suspicious death, an accidental death,
or possibly a homicide. We also, in our county, had another accident, a single vehicle accident that hit a parked car. Because of the autopsy and the information we found out through the investigation, the accident was staged. That person was deceased before the accident from a homicide, domestic assault. So we understand the needs of the religious objections and the religious issues, but we also want to make sure that there isn't other innocent victims involved in this, and that the person actually did a crime and actually killed somebody does not go scot-free. But thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Green. I think it's going to resolve some of the issues, but I think we still need to take a good look at everything and make sure that we do things the right way, respecting everybody's needs, and make sure that if somebody does something improper and that causes the death of somebody, that that person is dealt with properly as well.
Representative Vilsbrun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm so sorry to the family. I assume that we will be having those amendments that are all agreed to on the general register, and that I'll have the opportunity to review those amendments ahead of time.
Any other questions? Just curious, how many band are represented here today? Two? Fond du Lac and who else?
Boys Fort.
The reason I was asking, I used to work on White Earth, Net Lake, Red Lake, and one other one when I was the CO. So, all right, well, I thank you much for the bill, Representative Green, and any questions? If not, the chair will renew his motion for House File 1935 as amended to pass and move to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair of the committee.
Oh, yeah. Meeting adjourned.